Okay, so good evening. Lovely to see you all, as always. We have a double Parsha under pressure this week. There is a huge amount of material to cover. We're not going to cover it all in immense detail, but we'll run through the rough outlines of the two Parshiot, which are Matot and Maaseh. And they're radically different Parshiot in many ways. Matot is a parsha of activity and narrative and controversy in a way that Maaseh is mostly reporting laws, details, plans. Now, Parsha Matot has three major thrusts in the narrative. It begins with a speech, which will be the pasuk we put under pressure shortly. And that speech is, anyone know what Moshe tells the people about? Excellent. So I'm glad it sunk in 3,000 years ago. So we're going to turn to that and we'll talk about it shortly in more detail. He spoke to the leaders about Nedarim, about vows, which can get very technical. It speaks about if a daughter makes a vow in the household, the father can annul it. If he hears about it on the day that he hears about it, he makes that decision. Legally, halachically speaking, if a wife makes a vow, a husband can annul it. If a husband makes a vow, he's stuck. And those laws and details are all reported to Moshe by God and then by Moshe. And a question poses to where on earth this comes from. Why now are we hearing these regulations? Why now is Moshe telling the people about vows? What did we finish last week's parasha on? Pinchas finishes with what? Yeah, it's roughly that exciting. Correct. It's all the korbanot. And it finishes by describing voluntary korbanot. So some of the commentators assume that actually it's quite topical to speak about making voluntary offerings, contributions. So Moshe now gives the details of Nedarim. We'll come to other suggestions shortly. But that's the opening. And that's where the title comes from, Matot. What has Matot got to do with Nedarim? What is a Mate?
A stick.
A Mate is a stick. It also has another meaning, which are connected, which is a tribe. And here, Moshe speaks to the Rosh HaMatot, to the head of the tribes, and we'll speak to that particular point shortly. That's the first thrust of Matot, speech. From speech, we then have war. And war takes up the lion's share of the rest of the parasha. And this is a war launched against which enemy?
Midian.
Where, as a result of the plague and the depravity that Midian caused 2 weeks ago, which is what triggered Pinchas to act in his extrajudicial fashion, is now by God's law, this isn't a human initiative, God tells Moshe, go and take vengeance on the Midianites for what they did. Moshe gives them some instructions, tells them to go out. And by the way, at that moment, Moshe is warned again, this is the last act of your professional life. You're going to go to war against Midian, and then the time to come for you to die is here. And that just reminds us that we're now getting essentially to the end of the narrative of the Torah. Next week we'll be in Parshat Dvarim, and the book of Dvarim, how long does it take for the book of Dvarim to unfold in terms of the material that's covered there? How long in the narrative of biblical history does it take? So let's put it this way. How long is the book of Bamidbar chronologically? I'll ask it this way. How long were the Jews in the desert?
40 years.
40 years. So Bamidbar is just a little short of 40 years because they started in Shemot for about a year and a half. So it's about 38 and a half years. Say again? Okay. So Bamidbar is about 38 and a half years. How long is Vayikra? Not very clear. Say again?
It's not a narrative the way Bamidbar is.
Right, correct. Vayikra is very hard to pin down. There are small pockets of narrative. You've got the death of Nadav and Avihu. You've got the killing of the blasphemer. There are a couple of narratives here and there, but it looks like it doesn't really flow in the same chronological sense. Shemot is a couple of hundred years, because you go down, it starts with the 12 sons coming down, the 70 souls coming down to Egypt, and then they leave 210 years later, so you've got a few centuries there. So, and Bereishis, of course, is quite long. You start at the dawn of creation, and you end, what year is Abraham born in? Very, once I tell you.
1948.
Excellent. 1948, by Jewish calendar years, is the year in which Abraham is born. So Bereishis, and then Avraham passes away, and his grandchildren are alive. So you're talking about nearly 2,000 years is the book of Bereishis. Shemot's a couple of hundred. Vayikra is unclear, but it's not very long. It's got to be shorter than a year. And then you have Bamidbar, which is nearly 40. How long is Devarim? And Devarim, we know how long it is.
Takes place in the 40th year.
Takes place in the 40th year, and it is essentially Moshe's last hurrah. He gives a number of speeches. It's 5 weeks. That's how long Devarim is. And it doesn't, as you say, it's very hard to pin down again, because like Vayikra, there isn't really much narrative. It is all communication. It is Moshe rehashing, going through the history, summarizing everything they've been through, introducing some new laws that are particularly pertinent to their pivot into a new land. So Devarim, we're now at the end of, I wouldn't say biblical history because you've got the rest of Nach, but we're at the end of the end of Torah history at this point. We've got 5 weeks to go in Devarim, but no narrative really unfolds there other than Moshe's death. It's the end of Bamidbar, and we're wrapping up. And Moshe is told, go to war against Midian, and this is your final act on the material stage. So we then have the description of what happens in that war. And I'll tell you what happens in that war. 1,000 from each tribe go with Pinchas as the captain and others. They go and they slaughter all the Midianite men, and they kill the 5 kings of all those men, and they kill Bilam, their spiritual advisor. They burn all the towns to the ground. They take all the women and children captive. They seize money and property, and they bring it all back to Moshe. Now, does that sound like a gentle move on the part of the Jews? It sounds like the kind of behavior we would see on the news and call savagery, barbarism. They go to a place, they kill all the men, they slaughter the leadership, they burn the towns to the ground, they pilfer all the money and all the resources, and they take all the vulnerable people captive, and they walk back to Moshe. Now, how do you imagine Moshe, the pious figure who freed slaves from tyranny, how do you think he's going to react to what they've just done?
He's going to be mad because they didn't do enough.
So you got the answer right, and you got the next answer right, which is, if I were Moshe, I would be livid with what they did, which is precisely what Moshe is. He is livid. He's angry with what happens. But why was he angry, Mark?
He's supposed to kill the women too.
Because they weren't savage enough, it seems. Moshe says, how could you have done this? And for a moment, the soldiers are thinking, oh my gosh, did we go too far? What did we do? Moshe says, what have you got living women here? Kill the women. And they go, okay. I wasn't expecting that turn of events. And frankly, neither are we. We're reading this text, engaging a figure, our greatest prophet, who we identify with liberty and freedom and justice. And he is now enraged with the Jewish soldiers for not slaughtering all the women. And it's astonishing. And not only is he angry that they don't kill all the women, who else does he kill them to tell them to kill? Is keep the young girls alive.
Or the male children.
But kill the boys and kill the women. And this is, it's astonishing to read. And in fact, I don't necessarily have a good answer for you as to morally how we are to confront this, although Rav Yol Ben Nun has a very interesting read of this whole scene where he suggests that this is actually Moshe making a moral point, which would no longer be in effect in our day. But Moshe is morally perturbed by what the Jews have done, and he's making a moral point. My understanding is Shabbat afternoon we have Perek on the lawn, where the Kola pair are going to be addressing around Moshe's rage and the request that comes next that we're going to turn to. So I don't want to reveal too much in case I step on their proverbial toes. And you're all invited, I should say, to sign up if you'd like for Shabbat afternoon. We will, of course, be observing social distancing, masking, and it's somewhat of a trial. Everyone's going to be wearing masks. It may be impossible to hear, so we're going to see how it goes, but everyone's invited to attend that. But again, Moshe is horrified. And the one thing I'll note, because I don't think this will be touching on where they plan to go, is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has a book I've mentioned in the past called Not in God's Name. And the book Not in God's Name is essentially a response to religious violence. And when I say essentially, that's the subtitle. Not in God's Name, response to religious violence. And there's a very slim chapter I think I've mentioned in the past called Hard Texts. The opposite of soft, hard text. And he essentially says every faith has hard texts, difficult texts to confront. And I remember this kind of goes up and down. There are phases when Islamic radicalism is in the news and when, you know, coronavirus has pretty much occupied the headlines for the last few months. But I remember a few years ago in Chicago, Islamic radicalism was in the news and there was a healthy discussion in one of my shiurim, which had nothing to do with the shiur, but that was fine, about whether Islam is a religion of peace or not. And essentially, one of the sides said, well, just look at the texts. And then they pulled up a Google document that says, you know, you should kill this one, you should kill that one, and you should conquer this one. And the response of somebody else in the room was, well, have you read Tanakh? I mean, Tanakh is filled. And you don't just have to get to Tanakh. We've got right here, Moshe is livid because they did not slaughter the women. What are we meant to do with that? And again, one answer could be, I can't take this anymore, forget it, it can't be moral. But that's, of course, not our response. Our response is, and this is Rabbi Sacks' point, is that every faith has hard texts, and that's why we live in a world of interpretation. That's why we have commentators and sages, and that's why we are encouraged by those commentators and sages to grapple with the texts in a way that we can extract meaning. And that generosity with which we apply to our sacred texts and are invited to by God, we should have the charity to others who have hard texts to do the same. Now, if they don't engage with interpretation, and that's essentially what radicalism is, it's taking texts literally and having no room for interpretation. That's Rabbi Sacks' argument, is that radicals essentially look at a text that says, you shall kill, and say, I got to do it. I don't need to interpret that. I'm not informed by the whole weight of the canon that pushes me morally to question the literal reading here. If you look at the Torah, you have three psukim where Moshe is livid and tells them to slaughter the women. And you've got the weight of four other books that tell you to treat human beings with dignity, to treat life as precious, every breath as sacred, which forces us to look twice at this text and say, it cannot be, not just because my instinct says Moshe couldn't have said this, but because the whole weight of Jewish tradition says this can't be what Moshe meant. And if it is what Moshe meant, what does that mean? Moshe was wrong, which is plausible. Is Moshe ever wrong in Tanakh?
Yes.
Yeah. We had it in the book of Bamidbar. God said, you were wrong. You weren't Mekadesh Shem Shon, you're not going to Israel. And in fact, I will say one thing. The sages say that Moshe's anger here was misplaced, which is precisely why in the laws that follow, who speaks to the people, who talks to the people about, well, I'll tell you, the laws that follow about kashering and taking vessels to the mikveh when you get new vessels. And who gives those laws to the people?
Aaron.
So it's Aaron's descendants, Elazar, and he tells all the people, this is how you have to behave. And the question crops up, why is Elazar teaching the people? And there are some views in the commentators that say Elazar spoke out of place and he was punished because you're not meant to teach in front of your teacher, so to speak. But there are the sages, the Gemara, I think it's Avodah Zarah, says that Moshe got angry. And he shouldn't have got angry, and it was misplaced. And he was punished by not being the teacher of the next set of laws. So that's how we confront that hard text. And as I say, Rav Yoel Ben Nun has a reading, and I don't want to touch on it because he's a modern commentator, and I know the Kolas enjoy his views, so I don't want to spoil that per se. Okay, so then we move on. We have the laws of kashering. This parasha, Mato, is the source text for kashering pots and pans, for taking pots and pans to the mikveh, which is odd. Again, if someone were to tell you, where are all the laws about pots and pans and kashras, you'd probably imagine somewhere in Vayikra, along where you're talking about korbanot and how to do shechita and other things, what foods are kosher and not. And here it appears in the midst of war because they're acquiring new vessels, and presumably no one put the wrong spoon in the wrong dishwasher during the midbar. And now we've got the issue of what do I do with these vessels? And you either use fire, you boil it, etc., and you have to take it to mikveh. Which is an intriguing question if we were to launch into a halachic discussion. Why do pots and pans have to be put in a mikveh? People, when you convert, I get that there is a ritual association, but pots and pans, they don't undergo conversion when you put them in the mikveh, it doesn't seem. They don't have a change of faith. I don't put it in and it comes out refreshed and with a new view on life. It's a pan. What am I putting it in the mikveh? So we could talk at length about that too. And I should note, it's actually interesting. There is a debate about when somebody, a human being, converts into Judaism, all the pots and pans which they owned 10 minutes ago before they went to mikveh, they still own. They're Jewish, the pots and pans. Do they need to go to mikveh too? Because when you go to mikveh, you come out. In halachic terminology, kakatan shenoladama, you're like a newborn person, which massive halachic ramifications, hard to imagine, including halachically, you can now marry your sister or brother. Because you are no longer related. The biological connections that you had are severed by that transition through the mikveh, which not only leads to shifts in marital law, but also has questions about, often you'll have converts who lose a parent and say, I want to say Kaddish for my parent. Do I still have to observe Kivudav Ve'em? Halachically, what is the status of these relationships? Which again, we could get into a lot of discussions about. But the side point that I was leading to is there is a view that they need to take all their kalim to mikveh now because they've just acquired them from a non-Jew. Who do they acquire them from?
Themselves.
From themselves. And meaning it doesn't convert with them. There is a view that when they go to mikveh, everything they own gets transitioned as well. Either way, I'm not here to give an extra burden to those who convert to have to go to the mikveh with a whole house filled of vessels, but that's an interesting discussion, and it comes from this point. Now, we're then told about dividing up the spoils. How many sheep did they get for Midian? I will be shocked if anybody even guesses this right. Ballpark, how many sheep? 3 million? I missed that mark, you're muted, but you were right.
30,000-ish.
Wow. 675,000 sheep. And the only reason I mention this is not because that's an important detail for you to cling on to. There are more important things I imagine for us to hold in our minds. But I was surprised by that number. And it just tells you the scale of this war. This was not a simple tribal skirmish. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of animals and presumably a massive front. That the Jews went to war against. So 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cows, 61,000 donkeys. And here again, there's a little challenge here because after it describes all that animal numbers, we're then told there were 32,000 virgins, which again, why do we have a list of animals with young women appended to the end? And of course, that forces us to look back at this text, think about what is being said. Is this the Torah declaring a priority? Is this the Torah declaring the soldier's perspective and it's an inherent critique? What are we to make of this? And I'll leave that in your court, and you should feel free over Shabbos to take a look and have a think. We then have, that's the end of the second act of Parsha Mata. We had the speech at the beginning about vows. We then had the war and the fallout and the anger and the rage and the kashrus as a result of acquiring new vessels. And then we have the final act, which the Kol is also going to be talking about over Shabbat, which is the request from two tribes, Reuven and Gad, saying, we'd like to live on the east side of the Jordan. And what is the reason they give to stay on the east side of the Jordan?
Fertile land for their cattle.
Exactly. They have a lot of livestock that need grazelands. Is that what it's called? Grazelands? Doesn't sound right.
Graceland is where Elvis Presley lived.
Is that true?
Yes. Graceland.
Oh, Graceland. Thank you for contributing, Ellie. Much appreciated. Yes. So Elvis and Reuven and Gad wanted to be there. And there were grazelands, which is the wrong name, but I'm having a mental block, where they said, we want to be here for the animals. Moshe again reacts in anger. Oh, now that I remember, the Kolos were not going to talk about Moshe's anger in response to the war. They're going to talk about the anger here with Reuven and Gad. So I'll tell you what Rav Yoel ben Nun says, because I'm not going to spoil it. Rav Yoel ben Nun, sorry to backtrack a little bit. Rav Yoel ben Nun says, Moshe's anger with the people was, Moshe was trying to stop bloodshed. Moshe's goal was to end wars, to bring peace. And Rav Yoel ben Nun's suggestion is, in the ancient world, clans and tribes held on to resentments like national identities in a way that if there were survivors who were old enough to be inculcated with a sense of their identity, they would never let go. And if you had survivors, they would build up a resistance and then you'd have another war. And then whoever survived that, you wave the white flag, everybody goes home. You have another war. You wave the white flag and you go home. You have another war. Don't take too much out of what I'm saying here. This is not a prescription for our current situation. This is just an analog to help us understand what Rav Yoel ben Nun is saying. If we try to imagine the current crisis in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians, it's hard to imagine either side letting go of the resentments that have built up over the last decades, centuries, whatever you want to call it. And Rav Yoel ben Nun says, in the ancient world, the way to stop war and to save lives in the long term was to essentially wipe out the enemy. And Rav Yoel ben Nun said, and if you look at patterns as they unfold through Tanakh, this is what happens to different tribes. The Jewish people essentially wipe them out. Other figures wipe out other tribes. And then the wars stop. Now, of course, Rav Yoel ben Nun then has to pivot. This is an essay here. It has to pivot right at the end and say, but of course, we don't suggest that today. And the chief rabbi of the Israeli army, Rav Goren, said we should never kill civilians. We shouldn't kill women and children. Again, paskening for the Israeli army. Again, the reason he gave was that it's a chilul Hashem, that it would be... shameful morally on the Jewish people to do that, which Rav Yoel ben Nun made the point that, again, it's not inherently against Jewish laws of war to kill civilians in terms of biblical law, but it's just in a world where morals have shifted, it's improper. I'm not endorsing that view per se. I'm just sharing that view with you as a reading of why Moshe got so angry, not because he was livid and enraged and filled with wrath and he wanted to slaughter women, but because he said, look what you've done. You have not resolved the issue. Midian is going to fight with us again and again, and your children are not going to be able to sleep in peace at night, and your grandparents are not going to be able to sleep in peace at night if you don't end this now. And the truth is, Rav Kook has a similar, again, not a precise parallel, but a similar reading of the laws of war, where he says, look, when you look at biblical texts, and this is not the only scene, this is not the only hard text morally we have in Tanakh, there are other texts in the book of Samuel, in the book of Kings, in the book of Judges, where there appears to be some very difficult moments, morally speaking. And Rav Kook says, look, in the ancient world, if you lived by the UN Charter, you didn't last very long. if you lived in the ancient world and you said, well, we're not going to harm civilians and we're not going to go by surprise and we're going to give you warnings and we're going to drop leaflets in your camp before we come, the enemies would have said, what a bunch of fools. And they just wipe you out. And you had to exist in the reality you were in. And we have to update those moral standards through time. That's sort of Cook's suggestion. Again, I wouldn't endorse anything in particular. I'm just sharing views. It's possible that Moshe was just livid here. But again, it doesn't quite fit with some of the other attention here, because who led the forces to fight Midian?
Pinchas.
Who would you imagine should have led the forces?
Moshe.
Sorry, I thought Ellie said Elvis Presley. So yes, Moshe should have been the leader of the forces. He was the head of the people. Where was he? What is the traditional understanding of why Moshe did not lead the forces against Midian? Say that again, Chani.
His father-in-law. Midian.
So this is interesting, right? Meaning his father-in-law's there, his wife's there. But it's not just the family connection, meaning, oh, I've got a soft spot for them. But it's not a nepotistic, like, I can't attack them because my wife is from there. But it's a gratitude that, again, his wife came from there, but he was taken in by them. He was given food and shelter and comfort and livelihood. And he couldn't attack them because of a sense of deep gratitude. That's a traditional reading. There are other readings to suggest Moshe often didn't lead them to war. When they fought Amalek, Moshe sat on the mountain and held his hands out. He was not a general in that sense. But the traditional reading is he was out of a sense of debt and gratitude. So it doesn't fit to think they come back and he starts saying, go and kill all the women in a rage. He didn't go to war because he was so compelled emotionally not to attack them. So there has to be something going on in that moment. Okay, I feel better now because I that was sitting on my head. And the Kohlers are not going to talk about that. They're going to talk about why Moshe reacted angrily. I hope they don't talk about it. React angrily to Reuven and Gad, who say, I want to stay on the east side of the Jordan. We've got lots of animals here. We want to stay here. And the Kohlers are going to talk about why they really said that. Is it really just about the animals? Is something else going on? And I'll leave that unspoken now. And what Moshe's response is, how they come to an agreement, and then they accept essentially, say, yes, we'll come to Israel, we'll fight with the rest of the armies first, then we'll come back and we'll settle on our land, and they come to an agreement. Okay, that's the end of Matot, and we have 2.5 minutes left. That's not quite true. But then Masseh essentially is about the division of the land, a lot of details about splitting the land up and describing the journey on the way. So you've got all the stops described along the way. Why do we have to mention all the stops? Of course, that's discussed. We can leave that for another time. We then have Hashem telling Moshe they have to eradicate all the idols on the land, which is going to be repeated again and again and again throughout the book of Dvarim. Again, it's Moshe's final pitch to the people before they go into the land. He's going to tell them, get rid of all the idols, conquer the land, dispossess the inhabitants, which we're now coming up against, another difficult text where we're being told to go into the land, biblical text reports, go into the land, wipe out the nations, dispossess them, eradicate them, expel them. What are we to do with these texts? Should we just accept that maybe we shouldn't find it troubling and we have to accept that we have been inculcated with foreign values that make us soft and bleeding hearts? Or is there a way to say that maybe we need to look at this text differently? Again, people are going to respond differently to that, but I'll just throw that out there. For now, we then have the Levians described where they're going to be living. They don't get their own land. They get put in different cities. They've got grazing lands. Yes, grazing lands around, I don't know why that's sticking in my head, around the edge of the cities. We've got a description of Ari Miklat, the cities of refuge. Rabbi Sachs, Covenant Conversation this week, very poignantly, he wrote, I think it was a couple months ago, when Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who we mentioned in our electricity share, when he passed away, Rabbi Sachs, who was a student of his, said that he just started writing this piece about Matot Masseh, and he writes some, he has the liberty, the luxury of being essentially retired, where you don't have to write the drasha at some point during the week before Shabbat. So he writes them 6 weeks out. And he was just writing about a position Rav Nachum Rabinovich had touched on. And then he heard the news that he had passed away. And he said it was very touching and poignant. And you should feel free to look at that. One of the details of the cities of refuge is you have to be, as a refugee, as a inadvertent killer who is now sentenced essentially to a choice between being murdered by the blood relatives or living in this city of refuge away from your family until the high priest dies, you are given what you need to live. There has to be water. We as a society have to maintain those cities. We have to, as a society, maintain the roads that lead to these cities. So if somebody inadvertently kills, they don't have to start scratching on old maps to find the way. We have to put signage up to make sure it's very clear so people can get there speedily. We have to make sure, as I said, there's water. And the most important thing, the Gemara in Makot says we need to provide to those cities is teachers. And Rabbi Sacks has a long piece about education and schools and teachers as Jewish heroes, and his teacher, Rav Rabinovich, he writes at length about in that context. We then have a piece at the end of the parasha, which, again, maybe this is bad to admit as a rabbinic confession, but I'd forgotten about when I was looking at Shabbos Mincha last week. I was scanning the parasha again because I have to think about a drasha for the next week, each week. And there was the end of the parasha struck me. I don't recall having read it in detail before, where the relatives of Slavchad come forward and say, hold on a minute. Now that you've updated inheritance law and they can inherit on their own, when they please God, they go and we have a family simcha, they get married, all the land that belongs to the tribe of Menashe that they have inherited from their father is going to get parceled out to their husbands. Because you didn't update that. Husbands still inherit from wives and it gets absorbed into that tribe. What are we going to do? And essentially, the divine dictate at that moment is, yeah, there should not be intertribal marriage among women who inherit. Any women who will inherit have to marry men from their own tribe. It's the equivalent, alhamdulillah, of saying female New Yorkers who might inherit are only allowed to marry New Yorkers. They can't marry New Jerseyans, they can't marry Georgians, they can't marry Floridians, they can't marry Californians, because we don't want any of the potential inheritance that they get to go to the other states. And you imagine that would be a strange law to make, especially if we're less agriculturally focused. But that's essentially where it falls down. The 12 tribes are to live in 12 silos. And we'll talk about this, I'm sure, at some point in the future. But we are not just a single national mass. We are a nation built of 12 tribes, which had different cultures, identities, professional inclinations. It's the Havdal is like Harry Potter's houses. You know, you've got different identities, cultures, gifts, talents, inclinations, professions. And there is a need to preserve those separate identities to go forward. Now, okay, we've covered both those parashas. Now I'll share my screen to put under pressure in 3 minutes the beginning of Parashat Matot. I assume you see this on your screen.
Yes.
Great. We have here in the background Moshe speaking to the people, surrounded by text in a romantic evening. That's just a picture off the web. Now, Bamidbar. Vaydeber Moshe al Rashi HaMatot Livnei Yisrael. Somebody translate that for me. Moshe spoke al Rashi HaMatot Livnei Yisrael.
So the leaders of the tribes.
Livnei Yisrael.
The children of Israel.
Okay, so that's one way to do it. He spoke to the head of the tribes of the children of Israel. Now, it's hard to imagine he spoke to the head of the tribes of the children of Ammon, right? So it's kind of an odd expression. And also, Livnei Yisrael is, you would say, El Roshei Amatot B'nei Yisrael. What is the Le doing? It's very strange. One of the questions will be, maybe he's speaking El Roshei Amatot, and then we have to imagine the word and is there, Livnei Yisrael, and to the people of Israel. And there's this progressive speech happening. But before or instead of getting to that particular issue, we're going to ask the question of why here in this speech, when Moshe is talking about vows, nowhere else, not any other place in the Torah, does Moshe address the heads of the tribes on their own. Sometimes he speaks to the Kohanim, sometimes he speaks to the Eidah, which for some commentators means the judges, but for many it means the whole people. Here he speaks al Roshei HaMatot to the heads of the tribes, the political leaders, essentially. Why on earth when it comes to vows, in the Darim, does he only speak to them? That is our question that we will put under pressure for 6 minutes. Now, accompany me into the situation room for the first couple of views on this matter. This is the situation room in the White House. For those of you who've ever seen a drama involving American politics, you will have spent some time virtually in a form of this. This is the secretive, I don't think it's underground bunker, but it's a secretive chamber where high-level secrets are discussed, where foreign policy initiatives that are military are decided. This is high-level information, which we would phrase loosely as need to know. That's kind of the information. And that's the spirit of the first three views as to why Moshe only speaks to the Rosh HaMatot. And again, it's worth bearing in mind, we're not talking about secret foreign policy. We're not talking about military secrets. We're talking about vows. We're talking about who gets to annul, who doesn't get to annul, who has to keep them. We're talking about vows. But there is a view that actually, this was on a need-to-know basis. And the first view we have here is the Orachaim, al Roshei HaMatot. Why did Moshe speak to Roshei HaMatot? Shehem Gedolei Yisrael. They are the leaders. HaMitzvah B'Shleimut. So he told them the mitzvah in its totality. He gave all the details, all the laws, all the information. Aval Livnei Yisrael, Perush, Ki Livnei Yisrael, Bechlalut, Lo Yom Alehem. So he didn't tell the whole, this is essentially, he spoke to the Roshei HaMatot and then Livnei Yisrael, and he split it up. Unlike anywhere else in the Torah, it was split up in this way because the heads of the people needed to know these laws in their totality. The rest of the people, they don't need to know. They're not on a need-to-know basis. And I guess my question to you would be, why? Why, when it comes to vows, are the people on a need-to-know basis as opposed to anything else? And there are a couple of views. The Ramban suggests, Nachmani suggests, Ulai tzarich laha'alim. Maybe Moshe needs to hide Eila HaChukim Mehem, to hide these laws from the Jewish people. Why would you hide the laws of vows and pledges from the Jewish people? Shelo Yinagu Kala Rosh B'Nedarim, so they wouldn't take them lightly. This is an interesting moment. I don't know if there is a parallel in American law where we try not to tell anybody the law, but of course there are rules in public policy where we don't tell everybody. I'll give you maybe a contemporary example. There are, in theory, when you're dealing with the regulations around the current virus and the current crisis, there are probably situations in which, let's say, masks wouldn't be necessary because of other conditions. But it may make sense for public policymakers not to disclose that to the public, because then you get people saying, oh, all right, well, if you don't need it in that, you don't need it here. The whole thing's a fuss. We had, I saw the news today, the governor, is it of Alabama or Georgia, is taking cities to court who have made
Georgia.
Georgia are taking the mayors of cities to court to have a mask mandate, which of course is sending massively mixed signals to everybody in the state and across the nation. You've got governors protesting the mandate to wear masks. You've got mayors insisting that if you take them off, you could be a silent killer. What are you meant to do? And if you go to the people, the Jewish people, again, moving across to our circumstances, and you tell them, you should be very careful not to make a vow. Never, ever, ever make a vow. It's so important that we keep our word. Our words are our bond. But if you make it, you can annul it. And that was, oh, I can annul it. I'm going to go here. I'm going to go there. The whole thing comes to me. So the Ramban says, you tell the Rosh HaMatot, because they need to have the integrity. They need to know the law, how it works, how it functions. If there are cases that are exigent or emergent, they can deal with it. But the people, don't tell them. That's the way the Ramban view this. That's why it's so quiet and it's kind of snuck in here, aside from all the other laws, between Korbanot and a war. So they're hoping that everybody in Shul's fallen asleep in the laning. They miss this whole discussion and then they wake up for the war against Midya. And the Ramban suggests that's why it's only the Rosh HaMatot. The Ibar Benel goes to somewhat even more of an extreme. And he says, actually, it's not just that the leaders alone have the need to know. Of course, Moshe should have disclosed this back in Shemot, Vayikra, at the beginning of Bamidbar. At any other point, this should have been disclosed. Why does he wait till now? And he says, Moshe lo amram miyad. Moshe did not say this immediately, because Shem Am, when he heard these laws, Ela kafi azman v'makom shayu ra'uy elav, when the time was proper, kamanig tov masar mishubach, as a good leader. And then he goes on to suggest that Moshe had been dealing with all the vows until this point. Until now, if anybody made a vow they needed to annul, they came to Moses. And now Moses understands he's going to be stepping off the public stage. He's going to be retiring from his position. He needs to pass on these laws. That's why they appear now. Not only are the public kept out of the loop, but even the leaders are kept out of the loop until the very last minute. And it could be because of the Nachmanidean skepticism about public adherence, or it could be that there's a sensitivity here to vows about who can keep their word, who can't. There's a private dimension to these discussions, and maybe only as fewer people should be kept in confidence on this as possible. So that's the situation room response. We only have a couple minutes left. So there are five more views. I'll steer through relatively quickly, some of which are more involved than others. The first we'll do here is Rashi, who takes a very different view. This is not clandestine. This is not secretive. This is not underground. This is not in the situation room. Why does Moshe tell the Rosh Hashanah? First, very simple. To honor them. Chalak kavod l'nasiyim. He was giving honor and respect, reverence to these leaders. L'lamdam tchila v'achakach l'vnei Yisrael. So he taught them first, and then l'vnei Yisrael, he went to the people just to give honor to the heads of the tribe. Now, why does he need to give honor to the Rosh Hashanah at this point? It seems like a random time to say, hey, leaders, come, I want to give you some honor. Any thoughts?
Because they didn't do enough to stop the Magefa with the problems with Midian, with the...
Oh, fantastic. Was that a guess?
Knowledge.
Meaning somewhere in your head.
Yeah.
All right, there you go. So, correct. I also can't remember who said that, but somebody said that the reason Moshe needs to prop up the political leadership now is because of the abject failure in the context of Pinchas. Pinchas, who was not a head of the tribe, had to stand up and take firm action to stop what was happening. The political leadership looked detached. They looked ignorant. They looked neglectful. They looked impotent. And Pinchas had to take the lead. So Moshe at this point has to say, okay, guys, you took a beating. You need to come back here. I'm going to give you honor. I need to prop you up again in front of the people, give you legitimacy in front of the people a parasha later. So that's the way it's read here, that really there's nothing particular about these laws that apply to the leaders more than anybody else, but there's a need to prop them up at this point in the chronology. That's the way Rashi reads it.
One of the leaders was the one who sinned.
Correct. It's not only that they looked impotent because they didn't act, but one of them was the cause for much of the damage that had happened. Correct. Thank you, Elliot. As long as you don't mention Elvis Presley, you're doing very well. The Bechor Ashor says now that actually it comes at this point in the narrative because, again, Moshe's preparing to step down and he's setting up the leadership going forward. It's not just that they need to be propped up, but it appears right now because the infrastructures going forward need to be prepared. He just spoke to Yeshua at the end of Parsha Pinchas before the Korbanot to get him ready to lead the people, to describe to him what's needed. Now he's speaking to the Rosh Hashanah, the heads of the tribe, Lahanig et Yisrael, Derech Yashar, Lekayim Nidrei, Ma Sheidru Lefnei Makom, to basically supervise the culture, that they are ready to go forward. Now, Rav Shmuel David Luzzatto, who was an Italian scholar of the 19th century, biblical commentator, has a very interesting, if odd, reading in this moment, where he says that Moshe speaking to the Rosh Hashanah to essentially outline for them the limits of their power, to tell them, I bring up Hamilton too much because I watched it recently, but tell them essentially how to understand where there are balances of power set up in this moment. And the vows as a subject matter are particularly pertinent to the limits on their power, because what do the beis din, what do the leaders not have a power to do? They don't have the power to enforce a vow that somebody in a household made that the head of the household annulled. So the case Shadal describes is where a woman comes to the leader and said, I'm trying to make a neder, and every time I say, I swear, my husband says, canceled. I swear, canceled. I can't get a neder out. It drives me insane. So you could have the leader say, okay, husband, quit it. She wants to make a vow. And Shadal Shmuel David Lazato turns around and says, Moshe's telling the people, actually, you don't have power here. The Torah gives power to the head of each household. Families have a distinct hierarchy in the power dynamic where if the head of the household, whoever that may be, determines that they don't want vows to be taken in their homes under their roof, they have a right to determine that culture. Which again, Shmuel David Lozato, living in 19th century Italy, where they are forging the different infrastructures of government, separations of powers, which of course Italy crumbled and came back and crumbled and came back. But he's living in the modern era in the wake of the Enlightenment, where they are charting out social contract and other theories. He's suggesting that there is a privacy clause that basin have to get their heads out of people's houses. And that's precisely why Moshe is speaking to the people, not to buttress them in front of the people, as Rashi suggests, not as preparing them to lead the people, as the Bechor Shor says, but Shadal says, it's to essentially tell them, you have limits to your power. And we are not, again, talking about a national mass. We're not even talking about a tribal mass. We have families with their own cultures, and there has to be power in each home, because if heads of households are rendered impotent by the courts or by the political leadership, everything falls apart. People need to feel a sense of agency in their own homes, which of course is ironic because we're saying only one person has a sense of agency in their home and others don't, which we could talk about as well. Now, we have minus 1 minute, so we're going to wrap this up quickly. Two more views, very quickly. And they are opposite views. Here's a view which is in the name of the Likutei Batar Likutei, whose name I am blanking on. It's a recent anthology which takes psukim and assembles different commentaries on each of those psukim. And this is in his name, which he just says, Nira Lee. He doesn't say his name, so I can't remember, and I don't have it here with the clip. But he says, the reason that Moshe is telling the leaders here right now is because they might, the opposite of what Shadal said, is because they might think, we're leaders, we live in our palaces, we live in our governmental mansions, and we'll get on with just writing law and fighting wars and supervising the economy, but let people get up to what they want to get up to. And here, in his view, they're being told about this so that they should learn to enforce what happens in those homes. They need to supervise culture. If people are becoming light with language, and I guess to make this pertinent, right now, and I say right now, it's been the last 4 years, maybe more, the United States Congress and parliaments all over the globe are struggling because social media is a place of rampant bigotry, a culture of harassment, vitriol. People talk horrifically online because they've got a reduction in inhibition. And now there is a question. People put up false advertising, political advertising, and it's only been in the last month or so where Twitter or Facebook have decided to put labels on tweets that they deem to be problematic factually or otherwise, and they've been given pushback by that because of freedom of speech. And the governments are trying to come to terms with how do we manage public culture. And up till now, the position has been free speech means we sit back, you do what you want. And the result of that is foreign governments can now make false advertisements, pop them online, incite all sorts of internal tension. Again, this is not a dive into politics, but the report issued by the Mueller investigation, putting aside impeachment, Trump campaign, whatever it was, just talking about the substance of the investigation, showed that there were Russian agents who were trying to stir up an American civil strife. Politics, the suggestion was they wanted to set politicians against each other as well, but they had evidence of this Russian tech firm that essentially put up ads for a protest against Trump one day, and then ads for a protest against that protest the next day, and found susceptible followers on Facebook, and they stirred up a whole rally that would never have happened in a public protest and clash and violence that wouldn't have happened had they not done that. And the government has to now decide if they're going to regulate this. And here, again, this is not an exact analog, but it's helpful to contextualize. Moshe is telling the leaders, you have to supervise public culture. It is your duty. Yes, you can't get involved in people's private lives in their homes, But you need to supervise that people are keeping their word, that language doesn't get abused, that the currency of our trust doesn't get hollowed out. That's the way that the Likutei Bata Likutei reads that. And the final thing I'll share, which I think everybody across the political spectrum would endorse, the Chatam Sofer, not that you'd endorse him per se, but I imagine many of you would, but he suggests, why is Moshe telling the Roshei HaMatot about vows? Not just because they're responsible for supervising public culture, not just because they need to be propped up in front of the people, not just because they're leaders and they need to know the limits of their power, but because politicians, leaders, are ones who most often make public commitments. And again, the Roshei HaMatot were not elected per se, but when you're in a public position and you're asked by your constituency, there is a temptation to make promises, to give guarantees. And here, Dabar Moshe b'yichud l'roshei amatot, Moshe spoke specifically to the tribal leaders, to the political class, when he spoke about vows, not just because the laws were important, but to tell them, you need to keep your word. Because even though you have an obligation to regulate culture, to supervise the use of language, if you fail to use language well yourself, culture will crumble, regulated or not. And this is the way the Chatam Sofer and others, not just him, but others view this, that Moshe at the beginning of Matot, at the last moment before he launches it in his final speech, he says, okay, leaders, this is my final message to you before I turn to the people and I give my farewell address. Keep your word. Understand the weight of language. Understand that if you fail to uphold promises and keep guarantees, everything falls apart. Cynicism spreads through a culture like a virus, and it will bring it crumbling down. That is Moshe's final message to these leaders before he turns to the people writ large. And on that note, I'm going to wish you all a Shabbat Shalom. We went a little over, forgive me for that. And I will stop sharing my screen. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to take them. If you've got any rebuttals, I'm happy.